The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Okay, so let's start then, Rich. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's have you talk about your decision to start Innovest. What was the inspiration? What prompted you to decide to start the organization?
Well, I was working in a consulting department. I was managing director of a consulting department at a at an investment bank, and you know, we were working for a fee for a client. And I mean, this is back over 20 years ago, and the client had a manager that we didn't care for. And I can't remember if it was what the issue was, if it was qualitative or was it performance related. But we recommended to the client to terminate the manager. We're going through that process, and we get a phone call from the president of the firm, and he reminded us that we should not only take consider the interests of our client, we need to also consider the interests of shareholders. And that this manager that we were terminating was one of the biggest clients of the firm, and they weren't happy that they were being fired. And so we moved forward anyway. We made the termination, but it really made us think about why we were there and if we really wanted to be an objective client to or objective consultant advisor to our clients, we really needed to be at a place where we weren't conflicted, and that was how we got started.
So let me go a little farther back in time. You were studying for a business degree, a business finance degree, actually, at Western State Colorado University. At that time, what were you planning to do professionally? Did you already have something in mind at that point?
Well, back then, economy was pretty rough, and I knew I liked the investment business, and I had investment classes, and I enjoyed them, but I was told that I needed some experience, really some business experience. So I worked in a contracts department for a small defense contractor for a couple of years, and what was interesting was they were starting a 401k plan. This was back in the early 80s. And that was interesting to me. And it really made me think that I needed to go back out and talk to some of these firms again. And I ended up taking a job as a retail stockbroker at E.F. Hutton. So,
famous name.
Yeah.
Famous commercials.
Yeah. A long time ago.
So you took that job at E.F. Hutton, because I was going to ask you about, you know, what attracted you to financial services, private wealth business. What was the experience at E.F. Hutton? I mean, how did you, tell me a little bit about what it was like to come to work at E.F. Hutton, and I mean, what was the kind of situation where it's like, this is where I belong, and this is my place in life? Professionally, at least?
Well, I think in the brokerage business, what I quickly learned was it's really about sales, you know, and you have to build a book, and it was transactional, and they had very good sales training, much better sales training than investment training, and it was really about opening accounts and trying to develop relationships. So I realized that it really truly is about trying to build a book, and I think it's very difficult for most to do. I think it's even harder today than it was back then. I cold called a lot. You know, they touch at a cold call. I can't imagine trying to do that today with voicemail. I mean, there wasn't voicemail. You know, there wasn't the internet. There wasn't social media. I mean, it was but I was interested in management, and I did, you know, I did well in selling, but I think moving into management was attractive to me, and that's where I was. I ended up, you know, like I said before, managing a consulting department, and then you know, when we became independent in 1996, when we opened our doors, and we dropped our securities licenses, you know, so we're fee only. There were very few firms that did that. We were, I think it's very common today, but back then we didn't have a bunch of firms that we could look to that were doing what we did.
Now you're in Denver. Have you been in Denver the whole time, or have you been hopped around professionally, just in terms of geography, Rich?
I've been in Denver the whole time.
So Denver's a, I mean, I hear nothing but great things about Denver. I've been there. I've never lived there. What is it like in terms of your ability to attract talent?
You know, I just left a client meeting, and what's attractive, I think, to a lot of professionals out there is our culture and our approach. And we probably have never had so many really great people knocking on our doors. I wouldn't say that Denver is a hotbed of financial services, but, you know, in the last couple of years, Schwab opened up a big office. They hired 5,000 people. Fidelity has a big presence here. Some insurance companies have a big presence here. So it has definitely gotten a lot more competitive with financial services. And the economy is strong. I hear other firms in financial services say that they're struggling to find talent, but we haven't really found that. And I think it really is because of our reputation of a great place to work.
So along the way, the steps before 1996. Did I get that date right? Yeah, 1996. You were with Dane Bosworth, RPM, or RPR. How do you actually pronounce that organization?
R Prime Services.
R Prime Services.
Yeah, it was the consulting department at Rauscher Pierce Roughness.
I see. Okay. So talk a little bit about your experiences at those organizations, and what were some of the things that you would count as your accomplishments there?
I would say it was primarily working for fees as opposed to commissions. And so we would back then work with either institutions or large families, and instead of selling them products, we would work for a fee, and if there was any kind of commission that was paid, we would rebate that back to the client, where we'd negotiate that out so we could truly be objective. And that was highly unusual back in those days. You just didn't have it was more of an institutional model, where you saw, you know, institutional consulting firms working for fees, but you didn't see that in investment banks. And today it's a lot more common, but you still have the same conflicts of interest with these firms that we did back then. And it's that a lot of the managers, a lot of the solutions are clients of the firm. It's tough to get away from all that. So I would say, I mean, that doesn't sound like a big accomplishment, but I think that in hindsight was we were really thinking outside the box.
You know, I always like to ask people who start firms how they name their firm, what the story is behind the name of the firm. So you're Innovest Portfolio Solutions, portfolio solutions is a pretty clear phrase there. Is there any story behind Innovest?
Not really. I mean, just one of our, you know, we one of our people, we were just kind of brainstorming on different ideas, you know, using our names, and, you know, it came down to really innovative investment solutions. And we were using the name Innovative, as we liked that adjective, and, you know, it developed into InnoVest. That was it. So there's not a great story there.
So tell me about how the organization is different today versus what you originally envisioned. So often people come up with a business plan, and that business plan has to go through permutations because there's adjustments that's made. Whether it's market changes or it's just, you know, what we thought was there is a little bit different than what's really there, so we make adjustments. Is Innovest just exactly what you had envisioned, or if it has changed, how has it changed?
You know, when we started our firm, there were five of us. We had about 25 clients, but we knew that we had to grow, and we were just trying to survive, you know, like, you know, a lot of small businesses. And we were doing, we looked very different. We were doing things differently than most others that were former brokers. And it wasn't until probably 3 or 4 years later that we really decided to, you know, once we knew that we were going to survive, we needed to look beyond the next quarter and how we were going to make payroll. And I think the big difference today from back then was I think we had a very steep hierarchy. Even when we have about 47, 48 people here today. When we had 15 or 20 people, it was pretty much, you know, those at the top making all the decisions. And I think the way we're different today is we're flat, and I'm still the CEO, but we've empowered people, and we're a lot better firm because, you know, I don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. I can hire great people. Smartest guy in the firm. I can hire great people, and I think some of the things that we do today from an investment point of view or even a marketing point of view or the way we run our firm was somebody else's idea. And I think that's fairly common with a lot of entrepreneurial firms. You know, it's about grit and hard work, and then I think you plateau. And I think that's kind of what we did, and it wasn't until we flattened our firm and made others responsible and accountable that we really were able to grow significantly. And that's I don't think I would have ever envisioned that. I used to think that freedom, you know, people become entrepreneurs because they want freedom. But freedom, I thought, was control. And in hindsight, freedom means giving others control. But in a structure within a system that maybe you control or maybe you've designed, but you let other people run it, and it's worked well. And I think that's why people come here. I mean, I think that's part of our reputation. That's part of why we're a great place to work. People love here working here because they know that they matter.
So 25 clients has become 260 clients, mm-hmm. and with an average client net worth of $76 million and assets under advisement of $18 billion. Characterize your client base. What types of clients are attracted to Innovest?
So we really have three lines. We have retirement plans. That's probably about a third of our business, and those are their benefit plans. They're everything from 401k plans to health plans, VIBAs, and, you know, pools of assets or platforms where participants make their own investment decisions. But we work with the plan sponsor to design those plans. And then we have another line is the nonprofit world, foundations, endowments, sometimes just nonprofit long-term money, long-term investments that they need a fiduciary to act as an extension of their board. So we're always a fiduciary with our clients. And then we developed a high net worth line, and that's probably the fastest growing part of our business. And that within that we provide CIO services, chief investment officer services, to large families. So, you know, we become their advocate in the marketplace, and we provide a kind of a holistic approach to their wealth. And I think that's a natural extension of what we've done institutionally.
You know, one of the things that certainly has become clear to me from talking to a lot of different people in the business is that this whole idea of diversification, everybody talks about diversification, but it's really the definitions of diversification are very different from CIO to CIO or advisor to advisor. How do you define a properly diversified investment portfolio? And I realize, you know, there's a certain amount of customization, depends on the client, but generally speaking, what would you say are the hallmarks of a properly diversified investment portfolio?
Well, the way we start with a client is we quantify their downside risk. You know, how much they're willing to see their portfolio drop in a short period of time. And from there, once we know that, we build out a portfolio using, you know, stocks and bonds, equities and fixed income, you know, different strategies, you know, within that. But we believe in alternatives. We have, you know, we have a real asset allocation, a fixed income allocation, and an equity allocation. And so we'll, you know, liquidity is important. Some clients need a lot of liquidity, some don't. And if they don't, we'll use, you know, we use real estate as a component. Hedged equity, private equity, private debt. So all those strategies can be a big part of a client portfolio. They're probably not in a 401k plan that needs to be daily valued, but with large families and with pension plans and endowments and foundations, we certainly are using a very diversified approach. Reinsurance is an area that we believe right now is attractive. There aren't a lot of fat pitches right now, but we like reinsurance right now. And some of it has to do with, you know, the hurricanes and the belief that premiums in the insurance industry are going to go up significantly, and we want to be, we believe it's another area that is relatively attractive right now. But there aren't a lot of areas.
But reinsurance isn't reinsurance going to take a hit right now just because of the hurricanes and wildfires and such?
Well, it did take a hit. So that's what, I mean.
So now's a good time to get in, is what you're saying, is you feel like it's a good opportunity. Now, my understanding is they also recently, maybe it was unique to this firm, but the minimum investment had gone from $25,000 to $100,000, is my understanding. What's the minimum investment in reinsurance through Innovest?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I would think it's more than that.
More than 100?
Yeah. We're using products, managers, and strategies. So part of our role is to, negotiate fees and minimums. But and that varies from product to product. So I can find out, but I don't know.
Okay. So do you fancy yourself, you and your team, to be active or passive investors?
Well, we believe in passive management for some strategies, but we believe that we don't believe in just kind of set it and forget it portfolios. We believe you take advantage of opportunities. We're active rebalancers of portfolios. There are times that you need to take chips off the table. Taxes can be a big issue for families. We need to consider that. But we believe that maybe in some with some equity strategies, we'll just use indexes or ETFs. But in other areas, we believe in active management, and we go through a capital markets process every year where we look forward at capital markets expectations. And we do formal asset allocation studies every year for clients. And the reason we do that is we believe that there are times where you need to make changes, and that you need to take advantage of opportunities, or you need to pare back in some areas.
Talk about the with regard to high net worth clients. What are the components of a typical portfolio? And maybe you can even get into a little bit into denominations a little bit, if that might be stretching it a bit, but because I realize that each of them are different. But what about just generally speaking? Are the components of the high net worth portfolios?
Typically, and they're all going to be different. We're not a model based firm. You know, we do custom work for every client. Therefore, our clients are bigger, I think, than a lot of investment advisors. We charge more than probably most at the lower level because of the custom work. So, but their typical families can have equities. I mean, they're going to have fixed income. If they're probably going to be invested in municipal bonds, different fixed income strategies. But also, real estate, reinsurance today, some hedged equity, some private debt, areas that we, alternatives that we find attractive. Some of it depends on the liquidity needs. Some of it depends on downside risk. And so, again, we start with downside risk. But we want to build a tax-efficient portfolio as tax-efficient as we can. So we're trying to use tax-efficient strategies with the family.
Let's talk a little bit about the endowment model of investing. I mean, you obviously believe in alternatives. You believe in real assets. What is, just generally speaking, what's your opinion of the endowment model of investing, and how much of that is really used in your portfolios? I don't know that you would just say, yeah, we use the endowment model, but obviously there's principles of the endowment model that seem to be things that you adhere to.
Yeah, I think some of it's cyclical. When you're in a roaring bull market like we've been in, having a long equity portfolio with nothing else has worked the best. I think that, some of the things that we embrace are rebalancing. We really believe in rebalancing. That's part of the endowment model. But we're very aware of how fees can negatively impact portfolios. So we're probably not as heavily invested in alternatives as, typical large foundation. But we believe in some cases that having alternatives and paying more for those is a lot better decision than just buying fixed income. It yields where they are today. If interest rates go up, we're going to become a lot more interested in fixed income. But our clients have a lot less in fixed income than they did, 8 or 10 years ago. So I think we're not as critical of it as some, but we use some elements of it, and we believe in having investments that have a low correlation. And You know, that can work really well in some environments, and some environments, especially when you're in a big bull market, you know, it doesn't work as well. But you know, private debt, and you know, private debt we think is somewhat attractive. Some of it is, you know, driven by the difficulty that especially mid-market companies have in getting lending, and yields are pretty high there with really good companies. You know, they're not big enough to go to the high yield markets, for instance, or go to the public debt markets, but we find that attractive, and that can be a pretty big fixed income component of a large endowment or foundation.
So, it's to describe your management style.
Well, I think it's different today. Are you talking about my management style or investment management style?
No, your actual management style, how you manage your people.
You know, I used to be, you know, controlling, and like I said before, we have 12 partners here, and it didn't matter to me. I was the largest shareholder. I was going to make the decisions, and when we had times where maybe our growth wasn't as good, or you know, maybe we had lost a couple of key people. You know, I'm talking probably 10 years ago. My cage was rattled, and actually a consultant that we still work with today, kind of a personal coach, suggested that we needed to form some teams within Innovest to help, make some decisions about, maybe operations or research or, really anything, temporary or permanent teams, and that I could be a part of that committee, but I didn't need to always lead it. And I probably agreed to him reluctantly, and I think in the end that was a great decision, and that was really the reason that we empower people today. We get people really involved in decisions about the firm, whether it's their investment decisions or decisions about a new technology vendor or portfolio accounting or performance measurement or the way we handle anything operationally. We put together teams to do it, and I'm not a part of them. And, we make wonderful decisions because I think in hindsight, I'm not involved. And we hire talented, really focused expertise, and my expertise is a mile wide and an inch deep. So I think in the end, I'm very comfortable in taking the advice of others, and I think we're a lot better firm for it. And like I said before, I think that is attractive to those out there that are interested in a position with an investment advisor.
Talk about your decision to hire an executive coach. They talk about executive coaches. They talk about life coaches. Was yours a life coach or an executive coach or some fusion of the two? And why did you decide to make that move?
He's an executive coach. I joined an organization called Vistage.
I'm familiar with it. Okay.
Yeah. And Vistage is a very good organization. I mean, you're kind of dropping your drawers in front of 8 or 10 other firms and CEOs, and you're helping each other, helping each other get better, and you're all peers. And they helped us, and in fact, they were helpful in helping us through issues. But the executive, the I think he was the owner of the Vistage Group. I asked him if he would be interested in maybe working with us independently from Vistage, and in the end, he ended up leaving Vistage, and I hired him. And he's not a guy that has a bunch of clients. He actually runs another business, but we found him very valuable, and he's able to see the forest from the trees. We've made decisions that, in hindsight, they seem so simple, but we would have never done them if it wasn't for him. So we spend a half a day with them a month.
Interesting. So let me ask you this question. There's a book called Get Off Your Butt, and butt is spelled B-U-T. And I forget the author's name at this point, but he was a big executive in the institutional investment business at one of the major names on Wall Street. And basically his theory is, everybody, when you walk out of the room, people would say, Mike's a great guy, but. There's always this but, and it might be more than one but he talks too much, or but he's too critical, or whatever. What would your but be? When you walk out of the room, your team's there, they respect you, they love you, but there is this but there. What would it be?
I'm pretty influencing, and I think it's probably a fault of mine. If I want something, I'll build a case to get to to do it. I mean, it could be anything. I mean, it could be something operationally here. It could be personnel related or whatever. And what I've learned is that if I'm not a part of every decision, I'm not going to be overpowering those, everybody for the most part. I'm the largest shareholder, so they're under me, and I think I can be overwhelming at times with my way.
So it might be Richard. Go ahead.
It's a lot better today than it was 10 years ago, but it's still probably the butt.
I see. So 10 years ago, likely they might have said, Rich is a great guy, but he's too controlling. Nowadays, you're saying that you've come a long way on that. You believe you've come a long way on that. You don't need to be the decision maker necessarily. It sounds like delegation. And you even said freedom. Freedom really comes from being able to let things go and trust your people and so on. So interesting. Well, thanks for your honesty on that. So Innovest is clearly in growth mode. Where's the growth coming from? And again, I think you alluded to this earlier, but let's just for reiteration purposes here, the growth at Innovest is coming from where?
Well, it's interesting. It varies from, quarter to quarter, year to year. The retirement plan business, that's the biggest part of our business. I mean, that just kind of continues to come. We've grown our foundation and endowment or nonprofit business significantly. And I think consequently, and something that it took us a while to figure out, that has led to more high net worth business, because we're offering services to the nonprofit community, and a lot of influential wealthy people are seeing our work. So I think there's kind of natural leverage there.
So these are people who sit on the board of directors and maybe are contributors to the organization and whatnot.
Yeah. So or an investment committee.
Mm-hmm.
So our biggest growth has been in the high net worth space. All three lines have grown, but the high net worth space has grown even more. And when we think about where we want to add resources, provide other services, it's probably high net worth. And we are, we want to start a family office.
So that's in the future, starting a family office.
Yes.
Multifamily, what's the proper term? Is it multifamily office?
Well, yeah, we call it a custom family office, but you know, we would have multiple families that we would be providing family office services, and we're a consultant, and we think it's a natural fit. It's just, and it's really about helping our clients. I mean, I think in many cases we've had clients that have had this need for things that are outside of the investment business, and we can't help them. And I think there's a business opportunity, but I also think it is about doing more, providing more, you know, more solutions to client needs.
Such as they need taxes done. They might be looking at arranging to have a Gulfstream jet leased, but they don't know how to negotiate that lease. But they would turn so a whole variety of these things. Also, education of their children is some of the things that I've heard. You know, we need to teach them finance. We need them to understand the family dynamics, the financial dynamics, and so on. So you're being hired by endowments and foundations, and we're in what people call, it's become so hackneyed now because it's repeated so much, a yield-starved environment. Any foundation or endowment's going to want, you know, geez, we'd love 10% year-over-year growth. Given the current situation, and I don't know whether you would concur that, hey, it is a yield-starved environment, there's no question. You have to be realistic, obviously, with these organizations and these executives about what's realistic. What do you tell them currently in the current environment, what is realistic in terms of year-over-year growth?
I mean, we believe, you know, the future is, I mean, we've been through this, like, massive bull market, like I said. The future is low returns. And, you know, obviously they're low in the fixed income world. You know, a lot of foundations need to spend 5%, and the old formula is, you need to make 5% plus purchasing power, so maybe, let's say, 2%, so you need to make 7%. And that's gonna, you know, that's gonna keep your fund growing. We believe that if able, some of these, if they have that flexibility, some need to reduce their grant making, their spending, because of the low return environment. In other cases, we've talked to organizations about development, you know. If they develop, like universities, we have universities, I mean, there's a lot more pressure on, you know, their development team to go out and raise money because they're not going to get as much out of that portfolio. In other cases, it's about, you know, really understanding that downside risk and the detriment that can have to a fund. And even though, you know, you may not be growing at the clip that you wanted, looking forward, you need to accept it, or you need to take more risk, and everyone is different. But we believe that looking forward, it's a lower return environment, and it's, you know, if rates go up a lot, that would help. But valuations are stretched, there aren't many fat pitches, and yields are low.
So over the next 5 to 10 years, Rich, where do you want to take Innovest? Now, you mentioned a multifamily office. That's a big undertaking right there. Is that what you would count as over the next 5 to 10 years, I want to develop that, or are there some other aspects to the firm or some new services that you envision over the next, again, 5 to 10 years?
Well, I mean, I would say the family office will come sooner than later. I mean, we believe that we need to be there, you know, relatively soon, really to meet client needs and market needs. There are things that we do, like in the retirement plan space. We are much more design oriented. We're not just an investment firm when it comes to retirement plans. You know, it's compliance and portfolio and plan design and. You know, we help nonprofits right now with thinking about you know, impact investing if they're a nonprofit, and that's moving downstream, and we believe there are great opportunities for families family offices and especially endowments and foundations there. So we would probably continue to put more resources into, you know, impact investing.
When you say moving downstream, what do you mean by that?
Well, smaller organizations. So, you know, we're a mid-market firm. Impact investing is more common with a very large institution where, you know, they're able to invest in companies that fit their grant-making mission as well. So it's combining, you know, their investment philosophy with their grant-making philosophy. And when you're small, that's hard to do. And, you know, if it's, you know, like morally responsible investing or socially responsible investing, it's just harder to do and it's more expensive. So the bigger you are, the easier it is. But we think that is, you know, we think there are ways that you can do it even if you're a smaller fund.
So with regard to impact investing, what has been your experience in terms of what category of impact investing clients are most interested in? Is it poverty? Is it education? Is it the arts, the environment? What would it be?
I would say some of it is the poor. We work with quite a few religious organizations, and they focus on those areas. You know, it might be the environment. Mental health is a big deal right now to a lot of funds. How can we help these mental health centers help those that, you know, are just mentally ill? And so an example of an impact investment might be, and we have a client that did this. They financed a building for a mental health organization and gave them a favorable interest rate. So that's part of their mission. They want to help those that are in that arena, the mental health area, and this was a way that they could still get a real financial yield in a financing opportunity and below market financing opportunity in the mental health organization. They were able to get a much better situation than they could at a bank, for instance.
You know, this is the first time I've heard about mental health being an area. Is it that, why mental health? Is there any particular driver of that? Is it maybe, I know that health plans don't necessarily do a heck of a lot in the way of mental health. But our country also is just, you know, there's been this proliferation of shootings that are obviously some mental health issues are very much involved in that. Is there any particular driver of it that you could identify, Rich?
I mean, I think it's addiction. You know, there's, you know, even the president has talked about opioid problems. I do think it's crime related. A lot of the shootings, that have been recent, those involved have had a history of being of mental illness. Maybe it's Colorado. You know, we've legalized marijuana here, so that might be part of it. I just was at a conference. It was actually at the University of Wyoming the impact of marijuana, and I spoke on morally responsible investing when it comes to marijuana. But I think that mentally ill people, and this is, it's my opinion, but mentally ill people are drawn to Colorado because they feel comfortable with marijuana here. It's easily accessible, and they're self-medicating, so to speak.
I see. Okay. Interesting. So Let's talk about formative experiences, both personal and professional. What's been your most formative professional experience? What would you point to?
I think that professionally, it was probably, going back to 10 years ago, we had some, we had kind of partner issues, and that's when I was told that I needed to kind of, ease my way out of, making every decision, and I needed to empower other people. And that was through that executive coach. And I think that he helped me set up the framework, helped us set up the framework. I mean, another co-founder at InnoVest is Wendy Dominguez, and she and I, we were in this together. But I think it kind of flattening our firm, I don't need to be at the top of every decision. And just in hindsight, the impact that that's had on our firm, we survey our employees, and we've done it for a number of years. We want to know what they think about our firm and how can we get better. And the marks that we get continue to improve, and they're really, really good. And I think that stems from that decision 10 years ago to really flatten it out.
So talk about outside of work, your personal life. What event has happened in your life that you consider your most formative personal experience?
It's probably religious. I joined an organization called Legatus, and it's a Catholic organization for business leaders. And I joined it because, I thought there might be good networking opportunities, and there probably are. But we really embraced it, and we spend just a large amount of time with members of the organization that are just wonderful business leaders, fathers, mothers, husbands and wives, and they really, and it wasn't a conscious thing, but it changed the way we live our life and the way we think about other people.
So business leaders with this Catholic overlay. I was raised a Catholic, so I understand Catholicism. But what does the organization have to communicate to business leaders? What is kind of the philosophy behind it? Or what is it teaching business leaders?
Well, Legatus means ambassador in Latin. And it is helping instill Catholic values within the workplace. I mean, ultimately, that's their mission. And our mission at InnoVest is stewardship. I mean, our formal mission, we're not just an investment firm. We are stewards. We're stewards to our clients. We're legal stewards. We're stewards to our employees and their families, and we're stewards to the community. And when we talk about hiring people, we ask the question: are they stewards? I mean, are they men and women for others? Do they think about themselves first, or do they think about themselves last? And I think that a lot of that comes through the values that have been instilled in me, frankly, by the people that I meet. And we have a forum where I'm, very close to about 10 business, all men, business leaders, and we help each other with our business, our family, our faith. And like I said, it wasn't a conscious thing. It just changed my frame of reference in the way I think. And, I give Legatus a huge amount of credit for ultimately, the way I am and my values, but also the way our firm is.
So in terms of Catholic principles in the workplace, can you just go ahead and summarize? And remember, Rich, you can X out any of this that ends up in the article, but I'm curious, what are the Catholic principles that Legatus talks about integrating into the workplace?
Well, so with Legatus, what we do with Legatus is we meet, and it's a date with your wife, with your spouse. I mean, we meet once a month. We have dinner and we have cocktails because we're Catholic, and we have a speaker. And they can speak on. I mean, the speaker might be an author, it might be a politician, it might be an owner of a business. Legatus was founded by Tom Monahan, who founded Domino's Pizza. He used to own the Tigers, and it's an international organization. And this is a chapter here, and it's actually the biggest chapter in the country. That's what we do. I mean, and then we have a forum that we get together and we help each other through things. But ultimately, I believe that the mission of a Catholic is to be a steward, and it is to serve others, and not just just saying it or knowing you have to serve a client, but serving other people. Everybody around you, and when we hire people here, we only hire stewards. They're great professionals that have went to the best schools and have great experience, but they're very difficult to work with. Maybe because I call them a careerist. They want to be elevated in their career, and consequently they step on others in their way up. We focus on pulling people up here, and the best way to get promoted is to help the people underneath you, so when there's an opportunity above you, there's somebody there to fill your shoes. And I believe that's the Catholic way. And we don't talk about, the Catholic way. We talk about pulling people up. We talk about stewardship. We talk about men and women for others.
Sure. Yeah, you make it agnostic in the workplace, so it applies to everybody, or more universal. How many hours a week do you work, Rich, in a typical week?
Oh, probably 70.
It's a long work week. I'm not surprised, though. Being in the business that you're in and being at the top of an organization, what activity during the week do you enjoy the most that's just part of the, part of your duties, part of the work week that you enjoy the most or is maybe the most energizing to you?
I love spending time with clients. Maybe not with any direct responsibility for them. Maybe I'm not part of that investment team. I do have clients. There are people that I'm the lead consultant. But I that's very rewarding in getting to know them personally, especially if you have a chance to get them outside of the boardroom. And I love developing relationships, whether it's with clients or with people here, or people on the outside that refer us clients. So I think that's what I do best. I like to knock on doors. I like to be in front of people.
One of the things I noticed, you're involved in a lot of charitable organizations. This all makes sense to me now based on some of the things you were just saying. Can you talk about that commitment a little bit? You've obviously covered a lot of that, but is there anything else you would say with regard to you're obviously devoting a lot of time, effort, perhaps money to charitable organizations. You're obviously a practicing Catholic. Beyond that, or maybe another aspect to this that maybe you haven't already covered, talk about the commitment that you feel towards charitable organizations.
Well, we here at Innovest, we have a philanthropic mission, and that's inner city education. And we believe that, you know, in the end, that's the great equalizer. And for many that are in the inner city or just are poor, they don't have the same opportunities. So we, we're involved in organizations that help, poor kids get a better education. And I'm on the board of an organization. It's a Jesuit school, a Rupe Jesuit. And kids, the only way you get into a Rupe Jesuit is you're below the poverty line. And so you get a prep school education. And the way that's paid for is you go to school four days a week, and the fifth day they work. And we have a student from Arupe here every day working, and we pay their tuition, or at least part of their tuition, to go to just this wonderful school. And the benefits that we receive are huge. It's not just the child getting the benefit. They've made a big impact on our culture here, and people seeing really how these kids live and where they come from and how difficult their environment is. And there are other organizations like that we work with, but we embrace philanthropy here, and I do, my wife and I do personally as well. And a lot of it is educationally oriented. She was a teacher, and that's where we spend our time.
How many children do you have?
Well, we have two. Our kids, I have a son in college and a daughter. They're both athletes in college, and we really enjoyed the high school years. We enjoyed the college years and their athletic endeavors and traveling to watch them. My daughter was a swimmer at Purdue, and we went to almost every swim meet. So Purdue's not easy to get to. And my son is a college baseball player, and we're doing the same with him.
So your daughter's a Boilermaker, and your son is what?
Well, my son was a Sun Devil for 3 years, and he left Arizona State this last year to go to a smaller school, Division II school, called Colorado Mesa. So he'll be graduating this year. He has 2 years of eligibility. So this is a draft year for him. So if he has a good year, hopefully he's drafted.
So let me ask then. He's a pitcher. So what's his pitch? Is he a fireball or is he a fastball pitcher? Does he throw a slider, his pitch? Tell me a little bit about his pitching prowess.
He's got a pretty good fastball. He's left-handed. Probably his best pitch is a changeup. So he's, he throws a cutter and a curveball too.
What about your daughter? What's her best stroke? Is it breaststroke or freestyle or?
She was a butterflyer.
Butterfly. Wow.
Yeah, she was captain of the Purdue team. She actually had the Purdue fly record, 100 fly record.
Wow.
But I think it's been broken. But.
So let me get back to the firm. And I'm reading off your website, and it says, that research is a cornerstone of the firm, and that Innovest is powered by robust, independent research generated by our dedicated in-house research team. And my question is, there's so much research out there. There's so many organizations that do research. Why is it important, or do you consider important, that Innovest conduct its own in-house research?
Well, we think that others do a good job, and we read what others say. We're not held hostage to the research out of the big banks. We're interested in what they say. I think where we're different is really looking at a lot of the alternative products, where there really needs to be good due diligence and good research. And we really get deep inside some of these alternatives and do, you know, we do site visits, background checks. We really want to understand how these strategies work. And you know, at a big bank, the products you're going to get, they're going to be probably from a large firm. They're going to be able to be mass distributed because they have so many reps. And there are lots of good strategies out there with smaller firms that are, you know, really attractive, and that's where we focus. There's no institutional research out there on some of these. So, and that's an advantage.
Interesting. So now you also say that investors have suffered tremendous penalties by investing purely through a quote-unquote rearview mirror. Elaborate on that.
Well, investors chase performance. The better something is done, probably the more interesting it is to them. I think a good example is just this last year. If you would have looked at a lot of research the last year or a year ago, they would have said that, you know, non-U.S. investments probably aren't real attractive relative to U.S. because of a strengthening dollar, you know, weakness in Europe, weakness in Japan, and, you know, what's happened. We've had a very weak dollar. Currency translations have been very positive. You know, the optimism in Europe is really strong and outside the U.S. and international has really hammered U.S. investments. U.S. investments have done well. But non-U.S. investments have done, you know, really exceedingly well. You know, fixed income is another example. If you just looked in a rearview mirror, returns have still, total returns are still fairly high. But, you know, spreads have narrowed, rates are down, you know, with a lot of, you know, high yield, for instance. High yield levels are low. And they've done, high yield bonds have done really well, but they're not nearly as attractive in our mind. Looking forward.
Again, your firm says that it conducts extensive analysis on managers and constantly monitors their performance. Do you find a common denominator? And I've heard others say, you know, you don't look at the fund, you know, the manager, because you watch a fund, and then next thing you know, the manager's not there, and you haven't been paying attention. So, you know, you're looking for that star out there who can manage a fund and maybe moves on to another fund or starts his or her own. Is there any common denominator that you found that makes a fund or money manager successful, some characteristics that lend themselves to success in that realm?
Well, I think that, we like consistency. You know, firm consistency, a stable team. We look at how they manage risk. We really want to understand how they manage money. I mean, our work is just beyond looking at numbers. And I think we want to look for some of the same things that make us successful. You know, their culture, you know, we want to understand their culture. And, you know, that keeps a firm stable. And, the numbers get us interested, but, you know, there are lots of products out there with good numbers that we're not going to invest in because we're uncomfortable with the team or the culture. Maybe the process isn't repeatable. So.
Interesting. So, you also say that all too often the retirement plan marketplace can be opaque and confusing. Talk about that a little bit. Where do you see this opacity and confusion out there in the retirement plan market?
I think we see it in the retirement plan space. You know, investment menus in the 401k space, they can be, you know, they're too complex. You know, you're asking a participant that probably doesn't have a lot of experience or may not have a lot of experience to build their own investment portfolio and they have too many options. They don't have distinctly different options, and that can be a problem. They don't understand vendor compensation. There are some lawsuits out there, you know, suing big plans, you know, big 401k plans because of, you know, fees were too high or, you know, some of the retirement plan space is a commodity, especially the record keeping. And ultimately, the cost is the participant's cost, and it's just confusing. And it's not only confusing to participants, sometimes for plan sponsors, so you really need good advisors. And, you know, I think ultimately it's about, you know, transparency and the alternative space is really confusing to a lot of people. I mean, we if we're going to recommend a product, we need to understand it. We also do litigation support. So I think what gets investment advisors in trouble is they recommend things that they don't understand. And so it's not just confusing the participants sometimes, or to investors, sometimes it's the advisor. So what we've learned from doing expert witness work is if we're going to recommend something, we need to know it. And if we can't understand it, if we don't know it, we're not going to recommend it.
Mm. Now, you also talk about being committed to bringing the best ideas from the institutional community and applying them to individual investors. This is a big theme these days, this institutionalization of private wealth. What are some of the ideas that are being brought? I don't know whether it's Innovest itself that's doing this, or you're finding the products out there where institutional investors and product sponsors are creating products that the individual investor can access. So what are some of the ideas that are being brought from the institutional to individual investor?
I think private debt. I mean, we a lot of investors don't invest in private debt. A lot of high net worth investors don't. It's, you know, it's much more common institutionally, and we think it's attractive, and we've used it with a lot of high net worth clients. We think reinsurance is a, you know, we talked about it, but that's an institutional investment that we've brought to the high net worth marketplace that you just don't see high net worth investors investing in. You know, it's real estate, institutional real estate. People invest in, you know, they'll invest in an office building or a deal, or but you know, our approach to real estate is usually kind of a core satellite. You know, core manager will have diversification all over the world, or at least all over the country into different sectors, and that's hard to get if you're a high net worth investor. And we use it. And we think it's a, you know, good diversification tool.
Is there anything I've overlooked, or just something you want to add? Anything that you think is integral to Innovest, or you personally?
Yeah, the only thing that I can think of is, you know, when we hire people. I mean, actually, this you asked me a question about what you learned from a coach. This was a good example of how something seems so simple. And it was an epiphany. But, you know, when you're a little firm, you know, we're a little firm. We have, you know, like I said, 47, 48 employees. You lose a couple people, and that can be difficult. When you have 20 people, it's even more difficult. Or if somebody gets sick or they need to take time off, it can really throw a monkey wrench into a firm, you know. And our coach asked if we'd ever done attrition-based hiring, and we'd never heard of it. You know, I learned to be a business owner, you know, by being a business owner. And he said, "Well, geez, you know, you guys, you lose, you know, your attrition rate is about 10%, which is low. I mean, we lose 10% of our people historically, and so." You should go out and you should hire those four people right now or throughout the year with an expectation that people are going to leave. And we started doing that, and that made a giant difference in our firm. And we stopped casting a giant net. So we built a bunch of people that we knew and that we liked. And then, so if somebody left and we had a need and we needed to reach to that bench, we knew them, we vetted them, we vetted their character. We have a process that we take them through. And we know they're a steward. But if we found a first-round draft pick, somebody that was just incredible, we would just hire them and get them on the bus. And not really knowing where they might fit, but we needed them in our firm. That has made a giant difference in our firm. And the thinking that way about hiring people and not casting this giant net and these giant searches, we're targeting people, and people are coming to us, and if we think they're incredible, we hire them. And knowing that, you know, we're going to have probably somebody leave at some point in the next year, or, you know, if we lose 10, it, you know, if we lose 4 or 5 people, you know, that's about 10%. That has made a giant difference.
That's interesting. I haven't heard of that either. So I can see your typical business owner or manager saying, this is going to increase our costs because we're actually adding a person where there's not a slot available. You're saying it's made a huge difference for the firm. Talk about that. Obviously, you're spending some additional dollars, but do you end up saving money on the back end of the whole process? How has it made what is the big difference that it's made?
I think that we don't have downtime where we have to train. We lose somebody, we need to find somebody, we have to train them. So we have downtime, and so maybe, you know, we're paying people more, we're giving them bonuses because they're working harder and longer to cover that person that left. Now we don't have to do that. And we can focus on, you know, hiring great people instead of, you know, filling a need. And, you know, I can't tell you how great it's worked. And we just hired a woman that was a partner in Cambridge Associates, if you know who they
are. I do.
And she knocked on our door. And she lives in Denver. She lived in Denver. She commuted. She traveled. And she wanted a lifestyle change, and she knocked on our door. She's got incredible experience. She's a wonderful, she's a great consultant. She's a great person. And we brought her on board. And we just hired another woman that was actually a client. She worked for a large university. We loved working with her. Really impressive. She's got a PhD in economics. She knocked on our door. And those were two examples of first-round draft picks where we just thought, you know, we don't really have a need for them right now. We will have a need as we grow or as somebody leaves. And we want to make sure they're on the bus. And we'll figure out where they can best use their expertise. And it's just that the constant process of looking for somebody to fill a gap has just evaporated. And I think in the end we save money, and we have a lot more talent because of it.
These women who knocked on your door, what brought them to your door? Now, maybe they were knocking on a lot of doors because, you know, the first one you mentioned, she wanted a lifestyle change. So she goes looking, and maybe she knocked on a lot of doors, but maybe not. Did she knock on your door for a specific reason? Had she heard something about your organization? Did she know somebody in your organization that made her say, I want to see if I can get in the door at Innovest?
We had, she'd met a couple of us. I mean, we spent a little time with her, you know, just in the investment community here in Denver. She traveled a lot. We competed against her for a large family, head-to-head against Cambridge for a large family here in Denver. And she just knew her name in the community. And she wasn't out looking aggressively. She just thought that she would explore this change, and we made it work. And she's been with us a few months, and she's been fantastic. And the other woman, she worked with us as a client. She was our client. She was in the HR arena for a university, and was a former college professor, and we were really impressed with what she did in HR and what they considered, I think they called it human wellness. And when she knocked on her door, and we told her that, you know, if you ever decide that you want to talk to us, you know, the door's open, we'd love to talk to you. It wasn't for 2 years. You know, 2 years later she came and said, you know, I'd love to talk to you. So
under the old model, you would have had these two people come to your door and you would have said, gee, we don't have a position available, but we'll give you a call when something comes open. And by the time something came open, you call, they would have maybe landed somewhere else and you would have missed out on the opportunity.
Yeah, and we were so specific in what we were probably looking for, they may not have been a good fit. And now, you know, when part of this has to do with our size, I mean, getting bigger, it's hard to do when you're really small. But what's exciting is when somebody leaves, let's say a middle person leaves, there's going to be somebody below them that we're going to be able to pull up. And we have so many great employees that our challenge is to promote them and elevate them into areas that are more challenging for them and more rewarding. We do hire, students out of school, college kids out of school. We have an internship program, and we like to hire, what we call analyst assistants at that level. So, but we'll hire. We have a program where we'll hire probably two to four kids out of school every year, and then we'll hire more experienced people when we find them, when they knock on our door and we feel like they're a first-round draft pick.
And am I understanding you right, Rich, when you say you were so specific before, when you see somebody who's talented, maybe they don't fit a particular, like they're not like a perfect fit for the job, your biggest interest is bringing really good talent aboard, and then you apply it either as needed or in the way it's optimized best.
Yeah, and it's kind of goes, good to great, Jim Collins. I mean, that's kind of what he talked about in his book, getting people on the bus. And then, when you find that person, get them on the bus, and then you can figure out which seat they're in. Sometimes, in the beginning, they're in the wrong seat. But we eventually figure it out. One of the things that I've learned over time is it's really hard to change change a weakness. Everybody has weaknesses. I mean, I have weaknesses. We need to take advantage of strengths and not trying to change them. And I think we do a much better job there than we used to. And everybody here takes a test. It's called Strength Finders. And, we list their top five strengths. And it's actually hanging on either their cube or their office. So everybody knows what their strengths are. And, when we put together teams to work on projects or work on clients, we really want complementary strengths.